There were new and strange problems of social contact. The white soldiers, for the most part, were opposed to serving Negroes in any manner and were even unwilling to guard the camps where they were segregated or protect them against violence. To undertake any form of work for the contrabands at that time was to be forsaken by one's friends and to pass under a cloud. There was, however, a clear economic basis upon which the whole work of relief and order and subsistence could be placed. All around Grand Junction were large crops of ungathered corn and cotton. These were harvested and sold north, and the receipts were placed to the credit of the government. The army of fugitives were soon willing to go to work, men, women, and children. Wood was needed by the river steamers, and woodcutters were set at work. Eaton fixed the wages for this industry and kept accounts with the workers. He saw to it that all of them had sufficient food and clothing, and rough shelter was built for them. Citizens round about who had not abandoned their plantations were allowed to hire labor on the same terms as the government was using it. Very soon the freedmen became self-sustaining and gave little trouble. They began to build themselves comfortable cabins, and the government constructed hospitals for the sick. In the case of the sick and dependent, a tax was laid on the wages of workers. At first, it was thought the laborers would object, but on the contrary, they were perfectly willing, and the imposition of the tax compelled the government to see that wages were promptly paid. The freedmen freely acknowledged that they ought to assist in helping bear the burden of the poor, and were flattered by having the government ask their help. It was the reaction of a new labor group who, for the first time in their lives, were receiving money in payment for their work. $5,000 were raised by this tax for hospitals, and with this money, tools and property were bought. By wholesale purchase, clothes, household goods, and other articles were secured by the freedmen at a cost of one-third of what they might have paid the stores. There was a rigid system of accounts and monthly reports through army officials. In 1864, July 5th, Eaton reports, "These freedmen are now disposed of as follows: in military service, as soldiers, laundresses, cooks, officers' servants, and laborers in the various staff departments, 41,150. In cities on plantations, and in freedmen's villages, and cared for, 72,500. Of these, 62,300 are entirely self-supporting, the same as any industrial class anywhere else, as planters, mechanics, barbers, hackmen, draymen, etc., conducting enterprises on their own responsibility or working as hired laborers. The remaining 10,200 receive subsistence from the government. 3,000 of them are members of families whose heads are carrying on plantations and have under cultivation 4,000 acres of cotton. They are to pay the government for their sustenance from the first income of the crop. The other 7,200 include the paupers, that is to say, all Negroes over and under the self-supporting age, the crippled and sick in hospital, of the 113,650, and those engaged in their care. Instead of being unproductive, this class is now under cultivation 500 acres of corn, 790 acres of vegetables, and 1,500 acres of cotton, besides working at wood chopping and other industries. There are reported in the aggregate over 100,000 acres of cotton under cultivation. Of these, about 7,000 acres are leased and cultivated by blacks. Some Negroes are managing as high as 300 or 400 acres. The experiment at Davis Bend, Mississippi, was of special interest. The place was occupied in November and December 1864, and private interests were displaced and an interesting socialistic effort made with all the property under the control of the government. The Bend was divided into districts with Negro sheriffs and judges who were allowed to exercise authority under the general control of the military officers. Petty theft and idleness were soon reduced to a minimum, and the community distinctly demonstrated the capacity of the Negro to take care of himself and exercise under honest and competent direction the functions of self-government. When General Butler returned from Louisiana and resumed command in Virginia and North Carolina, He established there a Department of Negro Affairs, with the territory divided into districts under superintendents and assistants. Negroes were encouraged to buy land, build cabins, and form settlements, and a system of education was established. In North Carolina, under Chaplain Horace James, the poor, both black and white, were helped. The refugees were grouped in small villages and their work systematized, and enlisted men taught in the schools, followed by women teachers from the North. Outside of New Bern, North Carolina, about 2,000 freedmen were settled and 800 houses erected. The department at Port Royal continued. The Negroes showed their capacity to organize labor and even to save and employ a little capital. The government built 21 houses for the people on Edisto Island. The carpenters were Negroes under a Negro foreman. There was another village of improved houses near Hilton Head. Next, as to the development of manhood. This has been shown in the first place in the prevalent disposition to acquire land. It did not appear upon our first introduction to these people, and they did not seem to understand us when we used to tell them that we wanted them to own land. But it is now an active desire. At the recent tax sales, 6 out of 47 plantations sold were bought by them, comprising 2,595 acres, sold for $2,145. In other cases, the Negroes had authorized the superintendent to bid for them, but the land was reserved by the United States. One of the purchases was that made by Harry, noted above. The other 5 were made by Negroes on the plantations, combining the funds they had saved from the sale of their pigs, chickens, and eggs, and from the payments made to them for work, they then dividing off the tract peaceably among themselves. On one of these, where Kit, before mentioned, is the leading spirit, there are 23 field hands. They have planted and are cultivating 63 acres of cotton, 50 of corn, 6 of potatoes, with as many more to be planted, 4.5 of cowpeas, 3 of peanuts, and 1.5 of rice. These facts are most significant. Under General Saxton in South Carolina, the Negroes began to buy land which was sold for non-payment of taxes. Saxton established regulations for the cultivation of several abandoned sea islands and appointed local superintendents. By the payment of moderate wages and just and fair dealing with them, I produced for the government over $500,000 worth of cotton, besides a large amount of food beyond the needs of the laborers. These island lands were cultivated in this way for 2 years, 1862 and 1863, under my supervision, and during that time I had about 15,000 colored freedmen of all ages in my charge. About 9,000 of these were engaged on productive labor, which relieved the government of the support of all except newly arrived refugees from the enemy's lines and the old and infirm who had no relations to depend upon. The increase of industry and thrift of the freedmen was illustrated by their conduct in South Carolina before the organization of the Freedmen's Bureau by the decreasing government expenditure for their support. The expense in the Department of the South in 1863 was $41,544. But the monthly expense of that year was steadily reduced until in December it was less than $1,000. Into this fairly successful land and labor control was precipitated a vast and unexpected flood of refugees from previously untouched strongholds of slavery. Sherman made his march to the sea from Atlanta, cutting the Cotton Kingdom in two as Grant had invaded it along the Mississippi. The first intimation given me that many of the freedmen would be brought hither from Savannah came in the form of a request from the general that I would call at once to plan the reception of 700 who would be at the wharf in an hour. This was Christmas Day, and at 4 p.m. we had 700, mainly women, old men, and children before us. A canvass since made shows that half of them had traveled from Mason, Atlanta, and even Chattanooga. They were all utterly destitute of blankets, stockings, or shoes, and among the 700 there were not 50 articles in the shape of pots or kettles or other utensils for cooking, no axes, very few coverings for many heads, and children wrapped in the only article not worn in some form by the parents. Frantic appeals went out for the mass of Negro refugees who followed him. A few days after Sherman entered Savannah, Secretary of War Stanton came in person from Washington. He examined the condition of the liberated Negroes found in that city. He assembled 20 of those who were deemed their leaders. Among them were barbers, pilots, and sailors, some ministers, and others who had been overseers on cotton and rice plantations. Mr. Stanton and General Sherman gave them a hearing. As a result of this investigation into the perplexing problems as to what to do with the growing masses of unemployed Negroes and their families, General Sherman issued his epoch-making Sea Island Circular, January 18, 1865. In this paper, the islands from Charleston south, the abandoned rice fields along the rivers for 30 miles back from the sea, and the country bordering the St. John's River, Florida, were reserved for the settlement of the Negroes made free by the acts of war and the proclamation of the President. General Rufus Saxton was appointed inspector of settlements and plantations and was required to make proper allotments and give possessory titles and defend them until Congress should confirm his actions. It was a bold move. Thousands of Negro families were distributed under this circular, and the freed people regarded themselves for more than 6 months as in permanent possession of these abandoned lands. Taxes on the freedmen furnished most of the funds to run these first experiments. On all plantations, whether owned or leased, where freedmen were employed, a tax of 1 cent per pound on cotton and a proportional amount on all other products was to be collected as a contribution in support of the helpless among the freed people. A similar tax, varying with the value of the property, was levied by the government upon all leased plantations in lieu of rent. Saxton testified, "General Sherman's Special Field Order No. 15 ordered their colonization on 40-acre tracts, and in accordance with which it is estimated, some 40,000 were provided with homes. Public meetings were held, and every exertion used by those whose duty it was to execute this order to encourage immigration to the Sea Islands, and the faith of the government was solemnly pledged to maintain them in possession. The greatest success attended the experiment, and although the planting season was very far advanced, before the transportation to carry the colonists to the Sea Islands could be obtained, and the people were destitute of animals and had but few agricultural implements and the greatest difficulty in procuring seeds, yet they went out, worked with energy and diligence to clear up the ground run to waste by 3 years' neglect, and thousands of acres were planted and provisions enough were raised for those who were located in season to plant, besides a large amount of Sea Island cotton for market. The seizure of some 549,000 acres of abandoned land, in accordance with the Act of Congress and orders from the head of the Bureau for the Freedmen and Refugees, still further strengthened these ignorant people in the conviction that they were to have the lands of their late masters, and with the other reasons before stated, caused a great unwillingness on the part of the freedmen to make any contracts whatever. But this refusal arises from no desire on their part to avoid labor, but from the causes above stated. To test the question of their forethought and prove that some of the race at least thought of the future, I established in October 1864 a savings bank for the freedmen of Beaufort District and vicinity. More than $240,000 have been deposited in this bank by freedmen since its establishment. I consider that the industrial problem has been satisfactorily solved at Port Royal, and that, in common with other races, the Negro has industry, prudence, forethought, and ability to calculate results. Many of them have managed plantations for themselves and show an industry and sagacity that will compare favorably in their results, making due allowances with those of white men." Eventually, General Saxton settled nearly 30,000 Negroes on the Sea Islands and adjacent plantations, and 17,000 were self-supporting within a year. While 12,000 or 13,000 were still receiving rations, it was distinctly understood that they and their farms would be held responsible for the payment. In other such cases, the government has found that such a debt was a safe and short one. Negroes worked fewer hours and had more time for self-expression. Exports were less than during slavery, At that time, the Negroes were mere machines run with as little loss as possible to the single end of making money for their masters. Now, as it was in the West Indies, emancipation had enlarged the Negro's purchasing power, but instead of producing solely for export, he was producing to consume. His standard of living was rising. Along with his work of the army, the Treasury Department of the United States government was bestirring itself. The Secretary of the Treasury, Salmon P. Chase, early in 1862, had his attention called to the accumulation of cotton on the abandoned sea islands and plantations, and was sure there was an opportunity to raise more. He therefore began the organization of freedmen for cotton raising, and his successor, William Pitt Fessenden, inaugurated more extensive plans for the freedmen in all parts of the South, appointing agents and organizing freedmen's home colonies. On June 7, 1862, Congress held portions of the states in rebellion responsible for a direct tax upon the lands of the nation, and in addition, Congress passed an act authorizing the Secretary of the Treasury to appoint special agents to take charge of captured and abandoned property. Military officers turned over to the Treasury Department such property, and the plantations around Port Royal and Beaufort were disposed of at tax sales. Some were purchased by Negroes, but the greater number went to Northerners. In the same way, in North Carolina, some turpentine farms were let to Negroes, who managed them, or to whites, who employed Negroes. In 1863, September 11th, the whole southern region was divided by the Treasury Department into five special agencies, each with a supervising agent for the supervision of abandoned property and labor. Early in 1863, General Lorenzo Thomas, the Adjutant General of the Army, was organizing colored troops along the Mississippi River. After consulting various Treasury agents and department commanders, including General Grant, and having also the approval of Mr. Lincoln, he issued from Milliken's Bend, Louisiana, April 15th, a lengthy series of instruction covering the territory bordering the Mississippi and including all the inhabitants. He appointed three commissioners, Messrs. Field, Schickle, and Livermore, to lease plantation and care for the employees. He sought to encourage private enterprises instead of government colonies, but he fixed the wages of able-bodied men over 15 years of age at $7 per month, for able-bodied women, $5 per month, for children 12 to 15 years, half price. He laid a tax for revenue of $2 per 400 pounds of cotton and 5 cents per bushel on corn and potatoes. This plan naturally did not work well, for the lessees of plantations proved to be, for the most part, adventurers and speculators. Of course, such men took advantage of the ignorant people. The commissioners themselves seem to have done more for the lessees than for the laborers, and in fact the wages were from the beginning so fixed as to benefit and enrich the employer. $2 per month was charged against each of the employed, ostensibly for medical attendance, but the most plantations thus leased no physician or medicine ever came, and there were other attendant cruelties which avarice contrived. On 15 plantations leased by the Negroes themselves in this region, there was notable success, and also a few other instances in which humanity and good sense reigned. The contracts were generally carried out. Here, the Negroes were contented and grateful and were able to lay by small gains. This plantation arrangement along the Mississippi, under the commissioners, as well as the management of numerous infirmary camps, passed, about the close of 1863, from the War to the Treasury Department. A new commission or agency, with Mr. W. P. Mellon of the Treasury at the head, established more careful and complete regulations than those of General Thomas. This time, it was done decidedly in the interest of the laborers. July 2, 1864, an act of Congress authorized the Treasury agents to seize and lease for 1 year all captured and abandoned estates and to provide for the welfare of former slaves. Property was declared abandoned when the lawful owner was opposed to paying the revenue. The Secretary of the Treasury, Fessenden, therefore issued a new series of regulations relating to freedmen and abandoned property. The rebellious states were divided into 7 districts, with a general agent and special agents. Certain tracts of land in each district were set apart for the exclusive use and working of the freedmen. These reservations were called freedmen labor colonies and were under the direction of the superintendents. Schools were established, both in the home colonies and in the labor colonies. This new system went into operation the winter of 1864-1865 and worked well along the Atlantic coast and Mississippi Valley. In the Department of the Gulf, however, there was discord between the Treasury agents and the military authorities, and among the Treasury officials themselves. The Treasury agents, in many cases, became corrupt, but these regulations remained in force until the Freedmen's Bureau was organized in 1865. By 1865, there was strong testimony as to the efficiency of the Negro worker. The question of the freedmen being self-supporting no longer agitated the minds of careful observers. Carl Schurz felt warranted in 1865 in asserting, "Many freedmen, not single individuals, but whole plantation gangs, are working well. Others are not. The difference in their efficiency coincides in a great measure with a certain difference in the conditions under which they live. The conclusion lies near that if the conditions under which they work well become general, their efficiency as free laborers will become general also, aside from individual exceptions. Certain it is that by far the large portion of the work done in the South is done by freedmen." Whitelaw Reed said in 1865, "Whoever has read what I have written about the cotton fields of St. Helena will need no assurance that another cardinal sin of the slave, his laziness, inborn and ineradicable, as we were always told by his masters, is likewise disappearing under the stimulus of freedom and necessity. Dishonesty and indolence, then, were the creation of slavery, not the necessary and constitutional faults of the Negro character." Returning from St. Helena in 1865, Dr. Richard Fuller was asked what he thought of the experiment of free labor as exhibited among his former slaves, and how it contrasted with the old order of things. "I never saw St. Helena look so well," was his instant reply. "Never saw as much land there under cultivation. Never saw the same general evidences of prosperity, and never saw Negroes themselves appearing so well or so contented." Others noted, however, that the islands about Beaufort were in a better condition than those nearer the encampments of the United States soldiers. Wherever poultry could be profitably peddled in the camps, cotton had not been grown, nor had the Negroes developed so readily into industrious and orderly communities. Similar testimony came from the Mississippi Valley and the West, and from border states like Virginia and North Carolina. To the aid of the government, and even before the government took definite organized hold, came religious and benevolent organizations. The first was the American Missionary Association, which grew out of the Organization for the Defense of the Negroes who rebelled and captured the slave ship Amistad and brought it into Connecticut in 1837. When this association heard from Butler and Pierce, it responded promptly and had several representatives at Hampton and South Carolina before the end of the year, 1861. They extended their work in 1862 to 1863, establishing missions down the Atlantic coast and in Missouri and along the Mississippi. By 1864, they had reached the Negroes in nearly all the southern states. The reports of Pierce, DuPont, and Sherman aroused the whole North. Churches and missionary societies responded. The Friends contributed. The work of the Northern benevolent societies began to be felt, and money, clothing, and finally men and women as helpers and teachers came to the various centers. The scope of our work was greatly enlarged by the arrival of white refugees, a movement which later assumed very large proportions. As the time went on, Cairo, Illinois, became the center of our activities in this direction. It was the most northerly of any of our camps and served as the portal through which thousands of poor whites and Negroes were sent into the loyal states as fast as opportunities offered for providing them with homes and employment. Many of these became permanent residents. Some were sent home by Union soldiers to carry on the work in the shop or on the farm which the war had interrupted. It became necessary to have a superintendent at Cairo and facilities for organizing the bands of refugees who were sent north by the army. There was an increasing demand for work. New organizations arose, and an educational commission was organized in Boston, suggested by the reports of Pierce, and worked chiefly in South Carolina. Afterward, it became the New England Freedmen's Aid Society and worked in all the southern states. February 22, 1862, the National Freedmen's Relief Association was formed in New York City. During the first year, it worked on the Atlantic coast and then broadened to the whole South. The Port Royal Relief Committee of Philadelphia, later known as the Pennsylvania Freedmen's Relief Association, the National Freedmen's Relief Association of the District of Columbia, the Contraband Relief Association of Cincinnati, afterward called the Western Freedmen's Commission, the Women's Aid Association of Philadelphia, and the Friends Association, all arose and worked. The number increased and extended into the Northwest. The Christian Commission, organized for the benefit of soldiers, turned its attention to Negroes. In England, at Manchester and London, were Freedmen's Aid Societies, which raised funds. And funds were received from France and Ireland. Naturally, there was much rivalry and duplication of work. A union of effort was suggested in 1862 by the Secretary of the Treasury and accomplished March 22, 1865, when the American Freedmen's Union Commission was incorporated, with branches in the chief cities. Among its officers were Chief Justice Chase and William Lloyd Garrison. In 1861, two large voluntary organizations to reduce suffering and mortality among the freedmen were formed: the Western Sanitary Commission at St. Louis and the United States Sanitary Commission at Washington, with branches in leading cities, then began to relieve the distress of the freedmen. Hospitals were improved, supplies distributed, and Yeatman's plan for labor devised. Destitute white refugees were helped to a large extent, but even then, all of these efforts reached but a small portion of the mass of people freed from slavery. Late in 1863, President Yeatman of the Western Sanitary Commission visited the freedmen in the Mississippi Valley. He saw the abuses of the leasing system and suggested a plan for organizing free labor and leasing plantations. It provided for a bureau established by the government to take charge of leasing land, to secure justice and freedom to the freedmen. Hospital farms and homes for the young and aged were to be established. Schools with compulsory attendance were to be opened. Yeatman accompanied Mellon, the agent of the department, to Vicksburg in order to inaugurate the plan and carry it into effect. His plan was adopted by Mellon and was, on the whole, the most satisfactory. Thus, confusion and lack of system were the natural result of the general strike. Yet the Negroes had accomplished their first aim in those parts of the South dominated by the Federal Army. They had largely escaped from the plantation discipline, were receiving wages as free laborers, and had protection from violence and justice in some sort of court. About 20,000 of them were in the District of Columbia, 100,000 in Virginia, 50,000 in North Carolina, 50,000 in South Carolina, and as many more each in Georgia and Louisiana. The Valley of the Mississippi was filled with settlers under the Treasury Department and the Army. Here were nearly 500,000 former slaves, but there were 3,500,000 more. These Negroes needed only the assurance that they would be freed and the opportunity of joining the Northern Army. In larger and larger numbers, they filtered into the armies of the North, and in just the proportion that the Northern armies became in earnest and proposed actually to force the South to stay in the Union and not to make simply a demonstration, in just such proportion, the Negroes became valuable as laborers and doubly valuable as withdrawing labor from the South. After the first foolish year, when the South woke up to the fact that there was going to be a real, long war, and the North realized just what war meant in blood and money, the whole relation of the North to the Negro and the Negro to the North changed. The position of the Negro was strategic. His was the only appeal which would bring sympathy from Europe, despite strong economic bonds with the South, and prevent recognition of a Southern nation built on slavery. The free Negroes in the North, together with the abolitionists, were clamoring. To them, a war against the South simply had to be a war against slavery. Gradually, abolitionists no longer need fear the mob. Disgruntled leaders of church and state began to talk of freedom. Slowly but surely, an economic dispute and a political test of strength took on the aspects of a great moral crusade. The Negro became, in the first year, contraband of war, that is, property belonging to the enemy and valuable to the invader. And in addition to that, he became, as the South quickly saw, the key to Southern resistance. Either these 4 million laborers remained quietly at work to raise food for the fighters, or the fighter starved. Simultaneously, when the dream of the North for manpower produced riots, the only additional troops that the North could depend on were 200,000 Negroes, for without them, as Lincoln said, the North could not have won the war. But this slow, stubborn mutiny of the Negro slave was not merely a matter of 200,000 black soldiers and perhaps 300,000 other black laborers, servants, spies, and helpers. Back in this 500,000 stood 3.5 million more. Without their labor, the South would starve. With arms in their hands, Negroes would form a fighting force which could replace every single Northern white soldier fighting listlessly and against his will with a black man fighting for freedom. This action of the slaves was followed by the disaffection of the poor whites. So long as the planters' war seemed successful, there was little active opposition by the poorer whites. But the conscription and other burdens to support a slave owner's war became very severe. The whites not interested in that cause became recalcitrant. Some went into active opposition, and at last it was more desertion and disunion than anything else that brought about the final overthrow. Phillips says that white mechanics in 1861 demanded that the permanent Confederate Constitution exclude Negroes from employment, except agricultural domestic service, so as to reserve the trades for white artisans. Beyond this, of course, was a more subtle reason that, as the years went on, very carefully developed and encouraged for a time the racial aspect of slavery. Before the war, there had been intermingling of white and black blood, and some white planters openly recognized their colored sons, daughters, and cousins, and took them under their special protection. As slavery hardened, the racial basis was emphasized, but it was not until wartime that it became the fashion to pat the disfranchised poor white man on the back and tell him, after all, he was white, and that he and the planters had a common object in keeping the white man superior. This virus increased bitterness and relentless hatred, and after the war, it became a chief ingredient in the division of the working class in the Southern states. At the same time during the war, even the race argument did not keep the Southern fighters from noticing with anger that the big slaveholders were escaping military service, that it was a rich man's war and the poor man's fight. The exemption of owners of 20 Negroes from military service especially rankled, and the wholesale withdrawal of the slaveholding class from actual fighting, which this rule made possible, gave rise to intense and growing dissatisfaction. It was necessary during these critical times to insist more than usual that slavery was a fine thing for the poor white. Except for slavery, it was said, the poor would occupy the position in society that the slaves do, as the poor in the North and in Europe do, for there must be a menial class in society and in every civilized country on the globe besides the Confederate States. The poor are the inferiors and menials of the rich. Slavery was a greater blessing to the non-slaveholding poor than to the owners of slaves, and since it gave the poor a start in society that it would take them generations to work out, they should thank God for it and fight and die for it as they would for their own liberty and the dearest birthright of freemen. But the poor whites were losing faith. They saw that poverty was fighting the war, not wealth. Those who could stay out of the army, under color of the law, were likely to be advocates of a more numerous and powerful army. Not so with many of those who were not favored with position and wealth. They grudgingly took up arms and condemned the law which had snatched them from their homes. The only difference was the circumstance of position and wealth, and perhaps these were just the things that had caused heartburnings in more peaceful times. The sentiments of thousands in the upland countries, who had little interest in the war, and who were not accustomed to rigid centralized control, was probably well expressed in the following epistle addressed to President Davis by a conscript. It is with intense and multifariously proud satisfaction that he, the conscript, gazes for the last time upon our holy flag, that symbol and sign of an adored Trinity, cotton, niggers, and chivalry. This attitude of the poor whites had in it as much fear and jealousy of Negroes as disaffection with slave barons. Economic rivalry with blacks became a new and living threat, as the blacks became laborers and soldiers in a conquering northern army. If the Negro was to be free, where would the poor white be? Why should he fight against the blacks and his victorious friends? The poor white not only began to desert and run away, but thousands followed the Negro into the northern camps. Meantime, with perplexed and laggard steps, the United States government followed the footsteps of the black slave. It made no difference how much Abraham Lincoln might protest that this was not a war against slavery, or ask General McDowell if it would not be well to allow the armies to bring back those fugitive slaves which have crossed the Potomac with our troops, a communication which was marked secret. It was in vain that Lincoln rushed entreaties and then commands to Fremont in Missouri not to emancipate the slaves of rebels, and then had to hasten similar orders to Hunter in South Carolina. The slave, despite every effort, was becoming the center of war. Lincoln, with his uncanny insight, began to see it. He began to talk about compensation for emancipated slaves, and Congress, following almost too quickly, passed the Confiscation Act in August 1861, freeing slaves which were actually used in war by the enemy. Lincoln then suggested that provision be made for colonization of such slaves. He simply could not envisage free Negroes in the United States. What would become of them? What would they do? Meantime, the slave kept looming. New Orleans was captured, and the whole black population of Louisiana began streaming toward it. When Vicksburg fell, the center of perhaps the vastest Negro population in North America was tapped. They rushed into the Union lines. Still, Lincoln held off and watched symptoms. Greeley's prayer of 20 millions received the curt answer, less than a year before emancipation, that the war was not to abolish slavery. And if Lincoln could hold the country together and keep slavery, he would do it. But he could not, and he had no sooner said this than he began to realize that he could not. In June 1862, slavery was abolished in the territories. Compensation with possible colonization was planned for the District of Columbia. Representatives and senators from the border states were brought together to talk about extending this plan to their states, but they hesitated. In August, Lincoln faced the truth front forward, and that truth was not simply that Negroes ought to be free. It was that thousands of them were already free, and that either the power which slaves put into the hands of the South was to be taken from it, or the North could not win the war. Either the Negro was to be allowed to fight, or the draft itself would not bring enough white men into the army to keep up the war. More than that, unless the North faced the world with the moral strength of declaring openly that they were fighting for the emancipation of slaves, they would probably find that the world would recognize the South as a separate nation, that ports would be opened, that trade would begin, and that despite all the military advantage of the North, the war would be lost. In August 1862, Lincoln discussed emancipation as a military measure. In September, he issued his preliminary proclamation. On January 1, 1863, he declared that the slaves of all persons in rebellion were henceforward and forever free. The guns at Sumter, the marching armies, the fugitive slaves, the fugitives as contrabands, spies, servants, and laborers, the Negro as soldier, as citizen, as voter. These steps came from 1861 to 1868, with regular beat that was almost rhythmic. It was the price of the disaster of war, and it was a price that few Americans at first dreamed of paying or wanted to pay. The North was not abolitionist. It was overwhelmingly in favor of Negro slavery, so long as this did not interfere with Northern money-making. But on the other hand, there was a minority of the North who hated slavery with perfect hatred, who wanted no union with slaveholders, who fought for freedom and treated Negroes as men. As the abolition democracy gained in prestige and in power, they appeared as prophets, and led by statesmen, they began to guide the nation out of the morass into which it had fallen. They and their black friends, and the new freedmen, became gradually the leaders of a reconstruction of democracy in the United States. While marching millions sang the noblest war song of the ages to the tune of John Brown's Body. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. He is trampling out the vintage where the grapes of wrath are stored. He hath loosed the fateful lightning of his terrible swift sword. His truth is marching on,